Hello, I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk. Your support helps keep our program on the air and online.
Visit our website, philosophytalk.org, to keep up with the latest downloads and upcoming features.
And as always, thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW, San Francisco.
We're just continuing the philosophy conversations we have down at Philosophy Corner on the Stanford campus, though, Ken.
Yeah, and today we're going to continue talking about affirmative action, John.
Affirmative action. Now what is affirmative action? Anyway,
it's a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But the point of it is one of the points is to remedy the effects of past discrimination. You know, when I was growing up in the way back when, the things that a black guy like me could aspire to, seriously aspire to, were severely constrained because of discrimination. There was always being the first black this, the first black that. And it was like major achievements that haven't happened in the, 200-year history of the country. So affirmative action is helping to overcome the effects of that stuff.
Well, that's very nice, Ken, and I'm sure it's a worthwhile thing. But what does affirmative action mean? When I was a young assistant professor at UCLA back in the late 60s, early 70s, it was very clear. We were told by the university, affirmative action doesn't mean making your final decision on the basis of race or ethnicity. It means reexamining the criteria, say, for admission to your graduate program. Do you require a degree from a good university because you don't think people can come from bad universities? No. So reexamine your criteria and send your brochures out more widely, not just to Ivy League schools, but to Southern schools with heavy black enrollments.
Yeah, that's a
that's
good thing.
Not what it means now. It means reverse discrimination.
Well, I mean, it means something more than what it meant then, because in 1972 there was this executive order by Nixon, of all people, saying you need timetables, goals, and all this stuff to so that you can measure the progress. So it doesn't mean quite what it meant in your day. But let me ask you a question: how did you get your first job?
How did I get my first job? Well, I think it was a perfectly rational and fair procedure. The chairman of the philosophy department at UCLA called up the chairman of the philosophy department at Cornell University and said, have you got any hotshot graduate students? And my name was given to them, and the next day they offered me a job. I mean, it wasn't like they only called Harvard, so pretty fair.
Yeah, right. The old boys network worked for you, John. I mean, and that's what affirmative action is designed to do, break down these old boy networks. And, people like to think of these as things of the past, but they're not just things of the past. They're everywhere. They're all around us in contracting and hiring and all kinds of places.
Well, I have to agree. It's pretty pervasive. It's not just in education. Sometimes I think the real essence of affirmative action is we're making decisions all the time in our society based on illegitimate and unfair standards. Let's get being an Afro-American or being a Native American or being a Chicano included in that list. That's fair.
Right.
I guess that's a pretty cynical way to look at it.
California's been dealing with this for a couple of decades, trying to break down old boy networks, and our roving philosophical Amy Standen investigated some of those efforts. She files this report.
About 20 years ago, San Francisco city officials took a look at how the city was awarding private contracts and decided they had a problem.
City contracts were being let almost exclusively to businesses that were owned by white males.
Oren Selstrom is an attorney for the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights in San Francisco.
The city's Human Rights Commission gathered statistical evidence that showed that at the time in the early 1980s, less than 3% of all city contracts were going to women and minority-owned firms combined. A really infinitesimally small amount of what is hundreds of millions of dollars that is spent on public contracting in the city every year.
In an effort to diversify, the city came up with a new affirmative action ordinance which favors bids put in by women and minority-owned businesses.
To equalize the playing field, when a bid is submitted by a minority and women-owned business, a discount of anywhere from 5 to 10% is given to that bid.
That ordinance is still in place in San Francisco, but its days may be numbered, thanks in part to California voters.
Back in 1996, California voters adopted Proposition 209, which prohibits the state, including San Francisco, from using race or sex in its public contracting program.
Sharon Brown is an attorney for the Pacific Legal Foundation, which is challenging the San Francisco ordinance on the grounds that it violates state law.
The people of California said that they do not want their government to look at people differently solely on the basis of race.
Brown would like to see the city take steps to encourage all small businesses, regardless of the race or sex of their owners.
Just because a person is white and male doesn't necessarily make them privileged. When they look at the problems that the minority contractors and the women contractors are identifying, those are identical to the same problems that all small businesses encounter. And so why not do a program that helps everybody?
Proposition 209 does prohibit preferential treatment on the basis of race or sex, but it also forbids government agencies from allowing discrimination to take place. Oren Sellstrom says that without the city contracting law, that's exactly what would happen.
If the program is no longer in existence, we will go back exactly to where we were 20 years ago. We have just seen last year in the United States Supreme Court a ringing endorsement of the need for affirmative action in the higher education context, recognizing that, unfortunately, we still do live in a society where race matters and that government has a duty and a responsibility to make sure certain segments of the population are not unfairly excluded from participation.
But to Sharon Brown, that's just no argument for race or sex-based affirmative action.
That's discriminating. And we don't allow discrimination in this state, much less in the United States.
It's a question of how we want to deal with history. Does the fact that society has historically discouraged minorities and women justify doing the reverse, for a while at least, in modern times? Or is discrimination discrimination, no matter who it targets? For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
I'm John Perry. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. I'm here with Ken Taylor. Our topic today is affirmative action.
And here to help us talk about affirmative action is Elizabeth Anderson, joining us from the University of Michigan. She's a professor of philosophy and women's study and sometimes adjunct professor of law. She's written extensively on affirmative action policy. Liz, it's a pleasure to have you back again on Philosophy Talk. Welcome.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be back, Ken.
Hi, Liz. Good to talk to you again.
Hi, John.
Let me start off with this question. Now, we've heard about the importance of affirmative action in San Francisco's contracting policies, and we all know about its importance in higher education. Some people say that we should have affirmative action because it compensates disadvantaged groups for the effects of past discrimination. Do you think that's a good argument for affirmative action?
Well, we have to be careful about what we're thinking. I don't think affirmative action can be justified on the ground that it's compensating particular individuals for discrimination that they specifically have faced. Affirmative action programs, for the most part, don't look into individualized experiences of discrimination. I think it's more important to see affirmative action as an attempt to undo systematic structures of disadvantage that affect groups as a whole. And among those are things like old boys networks that operate against women and racial segregation, which operates fundamentally and primarily against African Americans and also to a substantial extent against Latinos.
Let me stop you for a second there, Liz. You said you don't think that affirmative action can, let me see if I can be justified in this compensatory model because the particular person who would benefit from it may not have undergone any particular discrimination. Now, on the flip side of that, it sounds like one might think the particular person who is disadvantaged by affirmative action, the white guy who doesn't get the job or the place from the law school or whatever, he didn't do anything. He didn't discriminate against anybody or she didn't, you know, that person didn't do anything to discriminate against anybody. So you benefit somebody who was done no harm and you harm somebody who did no harm. I mean,
yeah, that's
weird.
A fair question. Well, first we have to consider what benefits affirmative action brings. And if you think, say, in terms of racial segregation and undoing the continuing bad effects of racial segregation, what affirmative action does is integrate racially integrate mainstream institutions, especially institutions of higher education. That has very positive effects in terms of racial equality, in terms of promoting people's competence in interracial interaction. It helps create a racially integrated elite for the country that's better able to represent all of the problems that and be more knowledgeable of all the problems that all citizens confront. So there are many positive benefits that justify affirmative action that don't have to be justified in terms of benefits that accrue to the particular people who are advantaged or targeted by affirmative action.
But now, Liz, in giving that defense, frankly, it sounds a little bit like a blast from the past. We don't hear the word integration all that much anymore. We hear about diversity. Is integration, are integration and diversity two words for the same rationale, or do you have something different in mind than what people say now, affirmative action promotes diversity?
Well, when the term diversity was first introduced by Justice Powell in the 1974 Bakke decision, he actually used it synonymously with integration. But it came to acquire a bunch of other connotations that have to do with things like cultural diversity, rather than things that had to do specifically with overcoming segregation. So it came to acquire new meanings. However, if we look at the latest Supreme Court decision involving affirmative action, that's Grutter versus Bollinger, which upheld the University of Michigan Law School's affirmative action program, we can see strong integrationist themes reemerging, although under the vocabulary of diversity rather than, under the vocabulary of diversity rather than using the term integration.
Let's focus a minute on this distinction that you've drawn between diversity and the integrationist rationale, if you will, and the diversity rationale. I mean, does it really matter deeply if we think in terms of diversity as opposed to integration as a justification for affirmative action? I mean, is like arguments from diversity somehow weaker or stronger than arguments from integrationist concerns? I mean,
well, I think diversity talk has led us somewhat along a misleading path. Especially in higher education, where diversity, although it's often used as a code word for racial diversity, the official rationale tends to be focused more on cultural diversity. But if that's what really people cared about, then why don't we have affirmative action for foreign students over American students? We don't do that, even though they would provide much greater cultural diversity than any amount of within American affirmative action that we practiced. So if you actually look at the practices of higher education and admissions policies and so forth, you can see that cultural diversity is not really the fundamental thing that they care about. They're much more interested in racial diversity, and you have to ask why. And I think the best answer is because we live in a segregated society, and they're trying to undo that.
Well, that's interesting, Liz, because at Stanford, there's been a change, which as someone who just dips into the administration when I'm put on a committee or something, was kind of puzzling. It used to be that we had affirmative action for certain minorities, and they were the historically discriminated against minorities. And then this year, I guess having to do with these Supreme Court decisions, now we have diversity, and it's not limited to historically disadvantaged minorities, and it can be, you know, that you're the first kid that didn't go to college, or that you're the first kid in your family that went to college. You can be white as the driven snow, but still affirmative action. So yeah, it's been a real change.
Indeed. I mean, not only is it not limited to racial minorities, as the way Stanford's reacted to this, it can't be. It's not just they decided not. I mean, they took the decision to mean that they can't limit it to racial minorities, that they have to.
I think that's one of the legacies of diversity talk, is that you can't just have diversity along racial lines. You have to have diversity along a number of dimensions. And so you're talking here about class-based affirmative action. And I do think there are independent arguments in favor of class-based affirmative action as well. So that's probably a good move on the part of Stanford.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our guest is Liz Anderson of the University of Michigan. We're talking about what, if anything, justifies affirmative action. We've talked about the diversity rationale, the compensatory rationale, and Liz has mentioned integration. What do you think? Do any of these arguments move you, or do they all just leave you cold?
Give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or go to our website, www.philosophytalk.org, and send us a comment.
Philosophy Talk will be right back. Do you hear me?
nobody. Give me nothing.
The hardest working man in show business, James Brown. We're back on Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're talking with Liz Anderson of the University of Michigan.
We've talked about the various rationales for affirmative action. Later in the program, we want to talk about, does it work? Is it worth the social cost?
We'd like you to join our conversation. Let us know what you think about all these thorny issues. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also send us an email at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Have you ever seen affirmative action work or not work in your life? You might address yourself to that question. Liz, I want to ask you a little bit about integration. You obviously see integration as a positive value in society, something that is in the national interest and therefore justifies affirmative action?
That's right. There are two reasons for that. One has to do with equalizing opportunities in this country, and the other has to do with democracy. One of the things we do know about the effects of racial segregation that exists, especially at the residential level, is that it tends to isolate the segregated groups, the racially isolated groups, from economic opportunities. So, for instance, we do know that access to opportunities depends critically not only on what you know, but on who you know. If you only know similarly disadvantaged people because you're in a concentrated African-American community, say, it means you have less access to the social networks that govern access to jobs and other kinds of important opportunities. You have to know people who are already in the mainstream in order to get access to those opportunities. It's part of social networking. Segregation interferes with that and undermines equality of opportunity.
Well, let me ask you just a couple of questions that, at least superficially, don't seem to work on your rationale. One would be Native Americans. Suppose Native Americans want to stay in their communities. We call them Indian reservations. I don't know if that's a good term or not. Suppose they want to send their best and brightest to Harvard so they can get law degrees, so that they can do a better job staying unintegrated with the rest of society. Your rationale wouldn't work with them. And also, how about women? I mean, aren't women and men pretty integrated in our society as it is? So how can affirmative action have that as its goal?
Yeah, well, certainly with respect to women, you can't run quite the same argument about undoing segregation, because men and women are not residentially segregated, but they are highly occupationally.
Thank God for that.
They are highly occupationally segregated, though. And so I think there are strong arguments not only for affirmative action for women in occupations that they've been traditionally excluded from, but also affirmative action for men in occupations that they've been excluded from. And indeed, if you look across at various educational institutions, you'll find at my own University of Michigan, we do practice affirmative action for men in traditionally female occupations such as nursing.
Oh, that's interesting. Let me push on this a little bit, though. I mean, in the old days, you talked about the integration, going back to Brown versus Board of Education as being a rationale. And, you know, in the old days, the state had these laws that aided and abetted segregation, right? It prohibited
yes.
black people from going here, there, from enjoying this and that life. Those laws are all gone. Now,
yes.
take residential segregation. I mean, black people move into a neighborhood and the white people move out. They move out. They move into neighborhoods in Detroit, all over the place, and the white people move to the suburbs. Now, the state didn't do that. I mean, and if people choose to live here rather than there, I mean, what is the state supposed to do? Say you can't live here rather than there? I mean, how is that supposed to work? What's the justification when the state is no longer the agent of segregation, right? For the state intervening to try and change people's preferences.
Well, that's right. And so the state can't directly, there is freedom of association. I certainly wouldn't argue that the state can tell people they can't move into a neighborhood because it would throw it out of racial balance. But we have to be aware that current patterns of racial segregation are underwritten to a large degree by housing discrimination. You know, how do you preserve all white enclaves? Because real estate agents are practicing housing discrimination, which is illegal, against African Americans who might otherwise be interested in moving into those neighborhoods. So there is some scope for more rigorous enforcement of anti-discrimination law. But deep down, I agree with you that a lot of current de facto discrimination is really powered by private associational decisions, which are protected by our civil rights.
So when you,
and that's
a,
yeah.
So when you say integration is a social good, something we should work with, it sounds like the many of the people have been voting with their feet against you, against that view, in some ways.
That's right. But the state can do certain things to make members of different races more comfortable with that association. And one of the things they can do, especially, is integrate their own institutions.
Yeah.
So the state can integrate its public universities. The more contact people of different races have with one another, the more comfortable they are becoming friends and co-workers and even neighbors with one another. So the state can do things to undo the historic segregation that it created. It does it by practicing affirmative action.
We have some callers on the line who'd like to join this conversation. First up is Larry in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Larry.
Good afternoon. I think affirmative action, as it's currently practiced, is actually detrimental to diversity. You know, I could see affirmative action in a race-based affirmative action in certain limited cases, like if you have, as was often the case in the past, if you had a fire department that was all white, you might have a policy: we're only going to hire black people for a certain measure of time. That seems fair. That seems equitable. But I think if you want to have affirmative action address societal inequities, probably would be a lot more fair to base it on financial or economic standards rather than racial.
So Larry, you think that maybe there are these cases where race is a problem, like in the past segregated firehouses. But looking at the nation as a whole, it's really money and class that are the big sources of inequality.
Yeah, I think the way we practice it now, it actually subverts diversity because it keeps the old boy networks going, because they can justify not hiring a poor white person by hiring a middle class black person.
Right. So we've still got the old boy network. Now it just has some black males in it. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry. And we're here with Ken Taylor and Liz Anderson. What do you guys think about Larry's
comment? Liz, I wonder if you think an old boys network with some blacks and Hispanics thrown is better than an old boys network of just white guys.
Well, I'm a full believer in inclusion, and that means class inclusion as well as racial integration. So I'd be perfectly happy with a system that also took class considerations as a plus in admitting people to higher education or to certain jobs from which they've been traditionally excluded.
But I don't think it's either or.
That's correct. It turns out that even if you look at middle-class African Americans, they're significantly disadvantaged on account of their race and not just on account of how much income they have. If you look at, say, middle-class black neighborhoods, they show lower housing appreciation. They are charged higher interest rates on their mortgages. They have much lower levels of commerce because private firms usually don't like to set up their operations in segregated black neighborhoods. They suffer from enormous disadvantages really on account of their race and not on account of their income. So racial disadvantage is an independent variable here that needs some remedying over and above class-based disadvantage.
That seems reasonable to me. Thanks, Larry, for the call. JJ in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, JJ.
Well, hello, guys. I'm going to give you my opinion, I think. My opinion is that affirmative action is the national compass. I mean, it's sort of like the vision has been crafted through the courts from slavery to the present day. It was a means by which diversity was appreciated and celebrated. Today, we're living on affirmative compassion. Unfortunately, everyone doesn't know what that means. However, it's the only counterweight to groupthink. And one last thing, I'll just end it with that and let you take it from there.
Thanks a lot, JJ. I mean, I think JJ has a point. You know, it goes to the question, though, of whether you're right, Liz. I mean, you say, and I believe, that integration is a social good. Do we really believe that? And what are we willing to sacrifice to bring that about? You know, if so, affirmative action clearly has cost and benefits. Somebody doesn't get something that they otherwise might get, and somebody does get something that they otherwise wouldn't get. And those are experienced as gains and losses, right? But are we willing to pay that price for the social good of integration? I'm not sure that we've collectively answered that in the affirmative. What do you think?
Well, actually, I think it's very revealing if you look at what happened after Hopwood v. Texas, an earlier affirmative action case, overturned race-based affirmative action in the state of Texas. Immediately, the Texas state legislature implemented what's known as a 10% plan, where they said the top 10% of every high school class in Texas gets automatic admission to the University of Texas. There's no conceivable rationale for this other than to promote racial integration. What it suggests is that people want integration, but they don't want to use racial means to achieve that goal. But if they use an indirect means, okay, we'll take the top 10%. How does that integrate? Because they're relying on the fact that high schools are racially segregated. So the top 10% of a lot of high schools are going to be African-American and Latino. Well, now, it suggests to me that there is some support there, but they don't like the use of racial means to achieve that goal.
I think you've got a point there, Liz, but coming from Nebraska, which shares with Texas having a huge rural population, a lot of small towns, you would get considerable integration aside from racial and ethnic integration with that plan, because at least in Nebraska, there's a huge number of small school districts and where you can be in the top 10% and not have a chance of getting into the university on competitive exams. So there might be a little bit more to it than that.
I suppose that's right.
We've got a caller from Las Vegas. John in Las Vegas. You must be listening on the internet. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, John.
Yes, hi. Thank you. There were two things that I wanted to mention that I wasn't sure if you guys touched on. One was also there's a feeling of ownership over some of those seats by white people. I know a lot of white people who feel that it's kind of like an I-thou thing where it's like they are taking our seats, and there's that feeling of ownership that I think is bad. But also there's some detriments to affirmative action to African-Americans. My personal mentor, he's an African-American who went to Harvard, and many people don't give him the credit he deserves because they say he only got in because he was black. And so there are also detriments, I think, to African-Americans from that. But the big question that I pose is how can we, in a sense, without like indulging hypocrisy, say that affirmative action is good at 18 without admitting that we allowed inequality until 18? Because I am for affirmative action, but not the current definition. I'm more for it at preschool, because I think that's the way you give minorities the means to justify their ends.
So this is Jean-Pierre, am I right?
Jean-Pierre Perron.
Yeah, okay. Well, we got your question by email, too, so we appreciate your interest in Philosophy Talk, and I think it's a really good point.
Thanks, John. And Liz, you want to respond to this really good point?
Well, there's absolutely no doubt that affirmative action does have costs. And I think it does bring some resentment against the beneficiaries of affirmative action. I'm not going to deny that. But what I would suggest is that the reason why the beneficiaries of affirmative action are targets of resentment has to do with the fact that that they're black and Latino, and not due really that much to the fact that they are have been privileged by affirmative action. After all, you don't see the same kind of resentment directed against legacies such as George Bush, our president, who got in by dint of his father's alumni status at Yale University.
That's not totally fair, because his father may have only gotten in because of his grandfather, so you don't want to blame it all on George W. But that brings up a point I made not seriously before, but I think it's, in a way, we have all this debate about affirmative action where we kind of say, well, in a completely just society, could we justify having affirmative action? Yes, we can. No, we can't, so forth. But basically, isn't the real question, in a society then which there's all these non-individualistic group illegitimate sort of in a totally fair society factors, like did your father go to Yale? Did your father go to Stanford? Being part of the decision, do you have a lobbyist? Is your company big enough to take out the mayor to wine and dine in a society that is really based on, you know, all these kind of illegitimate factors? Why can't race and ethnicity be among the illegitimate factors that we're allowed to use without getting in a lot of trouble? To me, that's more the practical issue. Well, what do you philosophers think about that?
I don't know if I agree. I don't think race is. I think in a morally perfect society, race would be illegitimate because I think racial distinctions are invidious. They're not. They don't go very deep. They don't track anything of real significance. But here we are in a world in which people are treated differently. I just one of the things I think gets lost, and even our last caller, gets lost in this debate. You know how pervasive and systematic discrimination against black people has historically been in this country. How recent the doing away with the laws that supported this has been, and how much it has affected the lives and consciousness of black people. I think we lose that. So I don't know. I don't like to be in a soapbox, but this, you know.
Well, you're not in a soapbox. You're on a comfortable-looking chair.
But we have a caller on the line.
But you make a very good point, Ken.
We have a caller on the line. Eric in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Eric.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Get me off the hot seat here, Eric.
Sure. I had a comment about whether or not I've seen affirmative action working. And being a physician myself, I know that in medical training, at least, it's been shown that people who come from underserved communities are much more likely to go back to those communities and provide service for them. And I guess in that way, you can say that the affirmative action programs are working. For if these programs didn't exist and these physicians weren't being trained who come from these communities, there'd be nobody to go back. So I'd say that would be a good support for
the Erica. Yeah, it's a very good point, Erica. But now that Liz,
thanks for the call, Erica.
Yeah, thanks. It sounds to me like the diversity argument at work, right? The diversity argument, as I understand it, actually admits that look, we're an elitist society, but having diversity among the elites is a really good thing, and that's what universities want to have diversity among their incoming classes for. So their outgoing classes, the elites of the future, will be diverse. And diversity among the elites means that you'll have physicians and lawyers that are willing to go back into these non-integrated communities and not feel threatened or not at home in them. So what do you think of that?
Yeah, I agree with that. There is an important case, especially in medical schools, for affirmative action just to supply medical services to underserved minority communities. But that's a somewhat different argument from the integrationist argument I've been pressing. Another way to think about the importance of having a racially integrated professional class is that if you only have overwhelmingly whites and perhaps some Asians represented in the professional classes, they're going to be largely ignorant of the dramatically different life circumstances and personal experiences of African-Americans and Latinos. And that kind of lack of knowledge can have an impact on their own practice, not just in who they serve, but also in their larger understanding of things like healthcare policy and the differential impact of certain policies on different racial groups.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about affirmative action, the pros and cons, the rationale for it. Our guest today is Professor Liz Anderson of the University of Michigan. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or go to our webpage, www.philosophytalk.org, and send us a comment. Philosophy Talk will be right back. Why Can't We Be Friends? From War. I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry. Today our guest is Professor Liz Anderson at the University of Michigan, and we're taking your calls and emails about affirmative action. Liz, let me ask you this question. So maybe affirmative action is a good thing in that it has good results for individuals, groups in our society. But our society is founded, one might argue, on certain basic principles, the individualistic enlightenment point of view. The units of a democratic society are the individuals, not groups. And even if it's in everybody's interest, you're limited in what you can do. And so in giving up, I mean, isn't kind of intrinsic to affirmative action that at some point somebody's not going to be judged according to his or her individual attributes, but on the basis of a group they belong to? And isn't government recognition and advocacy of that really undermining something very important to American ideals?
Well, I would actually want to make the argument that the argument for affirmative action on grounds of racial integration doesn't even contradict meritocratic criteria. We have to realize that even when we use supposedly individualized meritocratic criteria, these are really group criteria, not purely individual. So, for instance, if we admit somebody because they have high test scores, this is based on a group generalization that people with high test scores, that group, tends to do better in the future in terms of earning high grades and so forth. There's really no way any criteria you use is going to be deploying generalizations about the population that manifests that criterion. So what can we say then about racial criteria? Well, we do, you know, one of the missions of universities in particular is to produce an elite that has certain kinds of competence, among which are interracial competence and interracial interaction. Most of the elite will not be able to have that competence unless they have actual experience interacting with members of other races on terms of equality. Given the realities of racial segregation in this country, very few of the students who would be admitted in the absence of affirmative action would be coming in with that kind of experience because they had very little interracial contact.
So if you
want to promote that kind of competence, that kind of merit, it makes sense to create a student body where students can learn from their differences.
So just let me note for those of you out there that want to continue to be puzzled by really basic philosophical conundrums, there is one here. We really think of ourselves as individualists, but all human judgment is based really in a way on stereotypes. So how does individual justice fit in here? We've got a couple of emails I'm going to read quickly. One is, why limit affirmative action discussion to black, white, and opportunity? The other is from CL, says affirmative action is sounding like the liberal version of trickle down.
The liberal. I wonder what that means exactly. I don't quite get that.
Yeah. Oh, I get it. Well, that is actually an important point. Affirmative action really is a policy primarily designed for elite institutions,
right,
at least when we're looking at, say, in higher education. Only highly selective institutions need to practice affirmative action to achieve racial integration. You know, most colleges in the United States are pretty much operating on open admission. Anyone who graduates from high school with a minimum GPA can get in, and often that GPA isn't that high.
But that raises an interesting question, actually, and it actually is something that genuinely puzzles me. I don't understand. I mean, I understand the arguments pro and con that we've been running through, but I actually don't understand the social heat that has been generated by the issue of affirmative action, because if you look at the number of whites who have been done assignable harm by affirmative action policies, it's got to be a diminishingly small number, right? Because if you look at the professional schools, you look at the law firms, you look at the medical practice, there still aren't very many minorities. So how many whites could have been excluded from access to these things because of affirmative action? Even if every black person who teaches at Stanford took the place of some white person, that's still like 14 professors. But there's all this anger about this thing, as if there's some great social ill done to the masses. I don't understand where that comes from. Do you?
Well, Ken,
you want a philosophical answer?
Ken, I think you're
that?
Right. No, I think empirically, Ken, you're right. Certainly at the higher reaches of elite institutions, you're certainly right. But if you look, say, more at working class jobs, affirmative action has had a tremendous impact on getting blacks and Latinos access to things like construction jobs and other blue-collar type work. And that's displaced a considerably greater number.
And also, you might have somebody whose family has been kind of relying on getting into a union for years, and all of a sudden they don't get into a union because some apprenticeship program that's got an affirmative action component. That kind of entitlement feeling, losing it, makes people really angry.
Right.
Talk to the Stanford kids that don't get in, even though they are legacies.
Well, that's true. But, you know, right, exactly. But, you know, you think, especially if you think about the elite institutions, what we were talking about for a while there, you think, okay, how many of these people who aren't at Stanford would have been at Stanford except for affirmative action? But how many believe they might well have been at Stanford except for affirmative action. A lot more believe they might well have been at Stanford except for affirmative action than those who, in fact, would have been at Stanford except for affirmative action.
I think you've answered your own question.
Yeah, but why do, I suppose. Let's take a couple more callers here. We got short time. Chris in San Francisco. If you keep it short, maybe we can get some more. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Chris.
Okay. Hello?
Yeah, hello. Are you there?
Oh,
Chris?
I'm sorry. Yeah. Yes, I was calling just to say, I was wondering why couldn't it be that the adverse reaction to affirmative reaction in white people, affirmative action, would be more like, wow, now I know how this kind of feels. Let me get together with other white folk and discuss what people of color have been going through for a long time and maybe build a bridge that way. It just doesn't work that way, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Well, I think it sometimes works that way. Some people do that. They just get kind of outnumbered by the ones who have a different reaction, I suppose.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Lisimba in Berkeley. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Lisimba.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to bring up the point, in the beginning of this country, we had, the European culture coming over, and then the African culture was brought over forcefully and in an inferior, stereotype. And the inferior stereotype doesn't seem to have changed, and I don't think media is really helping with it. And I don't think until these things are, until they're really, taken care of and discussed, I think government should have some kind of say on the media portrayal, because I think it gives people an initial bias towards racism.
Thanks a lot, Lisimba. Liz, that sounds like a comment up your alley. Am I right?
Yeah, I actually don't think the government's in a position to try to censor what broadcasters are doing. I agree, in fact, that a lot of media do engage in racially biased reporting with significant detrimental effects on the way blacks and Latinos are viewed. But given the First Amendment and freedom of speech, there's nothing that government can do directly about it. What it can do is take up its own megaphone and try to send alternative messages using its own voice. But it can't really control other people's voices. We do have freedom of speech, and that's a base value in America.
On that note, I'd like to thank you. Our guest has been Professor Liz Anderson of the University of Michigan. Liz, I was browsing around on your website, and I noticed that you have some links to various sort of useful resources, web resources on affirmative action and racial integration. Can you tell us your web address so that people can link to that?
I don't know it offhand, but you can Google me at Elizabeth Anderson at the University of Michigan. If you Google me, I will definitely pop up.
Yeah, and we'll put a link on our Philosophy Talk website to that. It's been a pleasure having you with us once again on Philosophy Talk, Liz.
Thank you. Great pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Liz.
So, John, what did we learn today? I mean, where are we?
What did we learn today? Well, we learned that affirmative action has different rationales and that one can be pretty skeptical, like Liz is, about one or two of the rationales and think a third one is okay. We never did get an answer about how Native Americans who want to stay in their tribal homes fit into the integrationist model of affirmative action, but I'm sure there is a pretty good answer. We learned it's still an issue that divides Americans.
Yeah, it probably will always be an issue that divides America, at least until about, 2050, when all of America is supposed to look like California with no racial majorities and therefore, I guess, no racial minorities.
So you can't at 2050, I'll be helping daisies of all colors.
I don't know. You take pretty good care of yourself. But, I do think.
But I'll be 107 in 2050.
I do think we've lost sight of the historical source of the need for this thing.
Well, I think you're absolutely right about that, Ken. I am an old white guy, but I've actually spent quite a bit of time with various African-American situations. And one thing that does strike me is that after 500 years of slavery, 250 years of non-slavery, isn't that long, you still see effects of two or three or four generations ago, just as you do in the Bush family, you see it in the Black family.
People moving out, people moving in, why? Because of the color of their skin.
Run, 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 but you sure can't hide.
Segregation, determination, demonstration, integration, aggravation, diminution, obligation to my nation.
Let me hear the man.
a terrible headache. I hear this thundering in my head. It's just pounding away.
That's not a headache, Ken. That's your conundrumming.
Oh, it's conundrum time. Usually we have people call in, but this time we have something special.
Right here in our studio, Gordon Earl. He's our executive producer, and he's very confused about something, and we thought emergency help was called for.
So, Gordon, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Well, it's good to be here.
What's your conundrum?
Well, it's a pretty serious conundrum. It really has to do about friendship and when you maintain a friendship and when you give up a friendship. I have a friend of mine who's been accused in a court of law of a really bad thing, and I don't want to go into details about it, but I can assure you it's very, very bad. And so the question is, and I've talked about this with other people, when do you give up a friendship when someone has been accused of something that's really bad?
Well, wait a minute. I mean, do you think that they actually did this thing?
It's hard to say. I don't know whether he's guilty or not. I certainly hope that he isn't guilty, but the nature of the offense is such that it's put a question in your mind and a question as to how you should act.
So in a way, your problem is anticipatory. Suppose you become convinced he is guilty of something you really heartily disapprove of. Should you break off your friendship because your friend has done something really bad? They haven't done it to you. My first initial reaction is, well, why is that a reason to break off a friendship?
Well, because, John. Because it shows something about the person's character and that you were deceived or deeply wrong about their character. And one thing that you care about in your friends is their character. I mean, especially if you think, like Aristotle, that friends are alike in character and they promote each other's good character, and that's what a true friend is. And if this person turns out to have a truly, truly, truly bad character, well, you think, oh my God, what have I got myself into?
Yeah, but I think you're buying a lot into the concept of character there. I mean, what people do is no doubt partly a function of what their character is, but it's also very circumstantial. There's this concept of moral luck. Most of us drive out of the driveway every morning and we never run over a child. And maybe we're careful 19 days out of 20 or 99 out of 100. But we all probably have driven out of the driveway in a way that if we were unlucky would have resulted in something awful happening. And maybe your friend did something that was awful, but it's not so clear he's that much different from how you thought he was or how we are.
What is a friendship for? I mean, what is a friendship about? Is it just pleasure in each other's company or something like that? You know, so you go fishing and no matter what else. I mean, that's a kind of friendship, but it seems like a shallow friendship. And this seems like more than that, Gordon.
No, this is a deep, intimate friendship.
Yeah, yeah. So you care about the character of your deep, intimate friends because it affects your... I hate to be a hard ass. I'm not usually a hard ass about this thing, but it seems to me the character matters.
This issue of do you make your friends pass a moral test? It might be good in forming friendships. Who wants to have friends that are moral creeps? But once you've got a friend, it's just not so obvious to me that I'd break off the friendship. I'd say, well, you know, I have some interesting friends. I have a friend who's a murderer. He's incarcerated. He's being punished. It's not my job to punish him.
I agree about that, but what about to improve him? What about to try and point his character toward the good?
Jesus, I can't get myself to quit procrastinating or eat fewer carbohydrates. I don't think I'm going to have much influence
John,
over my friends.
John, you have a very anti-Aristotelian conception of friendship, by the way. But, you know, that's a big...
I mean, look at you, Ken. What have I mean?
I know.
We've been friends now for 10 years.
Yeah,
and
you've improved me a lot.
Yeah, you're as obnoxious as ever. I mean, geez.
John, let me say one last thing.
I'm looking for guidance here, John. Are you saying friendship through thick and thin? Is there a philosophical underpinning to what you're saying?
Yeah, there is.
Well, there's a disagreement between Ken and I that seems to be philosophical.
Yeah.
So, Ken, what's your advice to me?
My advice to you. Think very hard about this one. That this is a deep matter. That if the guy's guilty and it really does reflect a deep defect of his character, then ask, can my being with him as a friend improve his character? If it can, then maybe there's a point to it. If not, then I'd say bye-bye.
All right, thanks, guys.
If you have a philosophical problem or quandary that's affecting your work or your play or keeping you awake at night, John and I would be happy to lend you some, philosophical advice or confusion or something.
Just send an email to conundrums@philosophytalk.org. Once again, that's conundrums@philosophytalk.org, or just go to our website and push the conundrums button with your mouse.
And join us next week when John and I discuss the philosophical issues raised by gambling.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2004.
Our executive producer is Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Nicole Sawaya, Roman Mars, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institution, the Greenwald Foundation, and the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from various groups at Stanford University, from the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW, Information Radio 91.7, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed on this program, though reasonable and deep, do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders or of anyone else, for that matter.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
He really is. You don't have to be skeptical about that. And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.